and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. So many stories and agendas and racial and power dynamics converge in today's story, or rather, the story told by an historian named Barbara Krauthammer. There's the story of the U.S. government's brutal treatment of Native Americans. There's the story of Christian missionaries sent to convert and, quote, civilize Native peoples. There's the fact that Native Americans in the southern U.S. owned slaves of African descent. There's also the story of racial ideologies, how whites viewed Indians and African Americans, how Indians viewed their black slaves, and how slaves viewed their Native American masters. Barbara Krauthammer's work reveals the complex dimensions, dynamics, and contradictions that, among other things, trouble the bright line distinctions we tend to make between colonizer and colonized. Krauthammer is an associate professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and the author of Black Slaves, Indian Masters: Slavery, Emancipation, and Citizenship in the Native American South. She also contributed a chapter about missionaries, slaves, and Native Americans to the volume Formations of United States Colonialism, edited by Alyosha Goldstein and published by Duke University Press. When Barbara joined me from the studios of WMUA in Amherst, Massachusetts, I asked her to describe the U.S. government's strategy in relation to Indians living in the Deep South in the early 19th century.
I think the U.S. government's relation to Native Americans in the Deep South in the early 19th century was complicated. On the one hand, there were certainly many people in the government and many civilians who wanted, with perhaps the best of intentions, perhaps not, wanted to recognize Native people's sovereignty and right to their territory, rights to self-government. But I think the story that perhaps people are more familiar with is the story of the rapid expansion of plantation slavery and plantation agriculture. And so I think the economic and social and political demands generated by Southern landowners, Southern land speculators, Southern politicians to open up more land to plantation agriculture, to that plantation regime, really drove the pressure to start the removal process, right? That forcible removal of Southern nations to the West. And that was a process that had roots that dated back to the American Revolution, right? As early as the American Revolution, early U.S. politicians were already thinking about how to consolidate U.S. control over that Southern territory. But the process really gained momentum and strength and violence by the 1820s, 1830s.
So the U.S. government wanted to relocate Indians westward in order to open up lands for plantations.
Right, for white landowners, for white men to own land and to make that land what seemed in the eyes of white Americans to be profitable, right, to generate capital and wealth.
And what other agendas or designs did the U.S. government have in relation to the Indians in terms of either assimilating them or just generally what they wanted to turn the Native Americans into what kind of people?
Right. Well, this was always the complicated and contradictory aspect of federal policy and benevolent societies, religious organizations' stance towards Native peoples in the Deep South, right? That simultaneously there was a sense that Native peoples could and should be assimilated into the American mainstream, right? The dominant white society, and that that assimilation could take place through conversion to Christianity, through English language education, through things like changing cultural patterns, changing dress and domestic lifestyles, changing gender roles. So really a full-scale cultural assault, if you will. And on the one hand, there was a sense that Indians could be integrated and assimilated into the mainstream society. And yet at the same time, I think there was always a sense of white supremacy that Native peoples could never fully become like white people, right? That they could adopt the cultural and economic and social patterns of the dominant society and be recognized as, let's say, aspirational, but that white Americans were probably not inclined to recognize Native peoples as truly equal.
You write that the federal authorities hoped to push Indians to adopt the practices of American yeoman farmers.
Right, that I think there was a sense that if Native peoples could be convinced or forced to own the land as private property, as opposed to owning the land as a commons, which those southern nations owned their land in common, right? Anyone who could farm and work the land could claim a piece of that land to work. And in the American system, people own land as private property and use that land to generate private wealth. And so I think there were for many people a vision of Native peoples becoming small landowners, small farmers, individual entrepreneurs, with the notion being that that would make them more like white Americans rather than less.
What did the organizations that sent missionaries to Indian lands in the Deep South, like lands in Mississippi where the Choctaw lived, what did these organizations, these mission organizations, think of the way the feds treated Indians?
I think missionaries and the churches that sponsored them had multiple visions of how the federal government treated Native peoples. I think on the one hand, missionaries saw themselves as benevolent. I'm not sure the Native peoples they lived among necessarily agreed with that perspective, but I think the missionaries believed that they were benevolent even when their treatment was harsh, right? Even when they imposed harsh discipline, corporal punishment, berated Native students in their schools, for example. I think they, the missionaries, believed that they were really being benevolent in that they were safeguarding Native communities from being overrun by white settlers, for example. At the same time, I think missionaries took a very critical and harsh view towards the Native peoples that they were ostensibly being benevolent towards. Right, that they were very critical of the lack of Christianity, of the unwillingness, right, and of Native resistance to Christianity, of Native resistance to dominant Anglo-American gender roles, for example. And so I think missionaries were in a bit of a bind and put themselves in that bind.
You mentioned that part of the agenda of the missionaries, or at least some of them, was to safeguard the Native peoples from being overrun by white settlers. So does that mean that they disapproved of the way the federal government was encouraging this white settlement and this dislocation and displacement of Native peoples?
Yes, well, I think their disapproval was directed perhaps more towards individual white squatters and intruders. And I think there was a sense as well that the federal policies towards Native peoples were too aggressive and were not humane. And so while missionaries were very much steeped in and embraced ideals of white supremacy, I think they also fancied themselves as better humanitarians than the federal government. And so that they really saw themselves as protecting Native communities from being physically assaulted by white vigilantes, white squatters, white land speculators, who they saw as having no regard for Native people's lives.
Well, this is an interesting question. The extent to which the missionary project fit within a kind of broader project to colonize and subjugate indigenous people and their land. So, to what extent did missionaries see themselves as proxies for the U.S. colonial project?
I think they saw themselves as proxies certainly for the social and cultural aspects of the colonial project, right? That they really believed in their Christianizing mission. They really believed in inherent and abstract values of English language education, of adopting American styles of dress, American gender roles and labor patterns. And so I think they were wholly committed to that and did not have an especially critical stance towards that. And I think in many respects, they were committed to the attendant changes in economic patterns, right? That they envisioned Native peoples remaining perhaps self-governing or quasi-self-governing, but really as an appendage to the American economy and the American social and cultural mainstream.
We could see the effort to convert Native Americans to Christianity as separate and apart from the project of appropriating and acquiring and taking Indian lands. Do you see those two projects as distinct?
I don't. I actually think that they're interwoven, because the sense among federal officials, among so-called reformers, and among missionaries was that that idea of being an independent landowner, generating wealth for one's own benefit, for one's family, was very much tied to what were seen as Christian ideals, right, of being virtuous and thrifty and diligent and hardworking. And so all of these ideals were really understood as Christian ideals. And so that conversion really went hand in hand with those sort of coercive changes in labor, in land ownership, in tribal sovereignty.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Barbara Krauthammer joins us. She's an associate professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and she's author of Black Slaves, Indian Masters, Slavery, Emancipation, and Citizenship in the Native American South. So you've investigated specifically, well, you've investigated many things, but I want to talk to you about your investigation into the lands that the Choctaw Indians occupied, resided on in Mississippi in the early 19th century, and the missionaries who came to set up shop there. And maybe we could begin with some basic facts about the Choctaw Indians and where they lived in this area and how long they had been there.
Sure. The Choctaws claimed, by the early 19th century, the Choctaws claimed almost all of what we know as the state of Mississippi as their territory. And their right to that territory had been recognized by European empires, the Spanish, the French, the British. Their claims to that territory came under assault in the years after the American Revolution, and then after the U.S. gained control of that Louisiana territory after Jefferson's Louisiana Purchase. And their claims to the territory come under assault because of the rivers that run through that territory, because of access to New Orleans and trade routes that Americans were now interested in controlling and capitalizing on. Choctaw roots in the Mississippi Territory went back hundreds, thousands of years, right? And there are many wonderful studies about the ancient Mississippi kingdoms and chiefdoms in the region. But certainly, right, we can think back to the 16th century and early records by Europeans arriving in that region and interacting with the early Choctaw peoples, right? The peoples who would coalesce into the Choctaw Nation of the 19th century.
And by the time the missionaries arrived in Choctaw territory in the early 1800s, to what extent had the tribe or parts of it been displaced already, made to give up their lands prior to 1818, 1820?
So prior to the 1820s, small factions had been displaced, partially in consequence, as a consequence of intertribal rivalries. But really, the large-scale displacement doesn't happen until the late 1820s and the early 1830s. And so there's this moment in time when missionaries arrive in the Choctaw Territory in Mississippi and build schools and churches and mission stations. And the Choctaws have a complicated, intense relationship with those missionaries, because I think on the one hand, there's a sense, at least among some Choctaw leaders, that hosting the missionaries and accepting the missionary presence might be a good strategy for ultimately safeguarding Choctaw territory and Choctaw political autonomy, Right. That is, by accepting these envoys from the United States, these sort of quasi-independent, quasi-governmental representatives, that Choctaw leaders might be able to position themselves and their nation as willing allies with American economic agendas, American social values, American cultural and religious practices. But that's a very short-lived moment.
And I want to get back to that, this interesting question of what the Indians believe they could acquire from, appropriate from the missionaries and the education provided by the missions to their advantage, to the Native Americans' advantage. But before we get there, there's an interesting fact that I don't think is widely known, and that is, as you claim, Choctaw Indians, some of them, owned slaves.
Many Southern Native peoples owned African Americans as slaves, as property, as chattel. And the interesting history that is not very widely known, though I think is gaining some ground, is this interesting moment in the 1700s under French colonialism, Spanish colonialism, British colonialism in this southeastern territory, a shift in Native patterns of captivity and subordination. And so peoples like the Choctaw, for example, had previously held other Native peoples as subordinates and servants. And after many generations of contact with colonial officials, Spanish, French, and British, and after many years of encountering the rise of African enslavement in North America, there's a slow but definitive shift among the Choctaws and many other Native communities, a shift away from holding other Native peoples as subordinates and servants towards taking Africans and African Americans as subordinates and keeping them in a subordinate position, right? That is not opening ways for people to gain freedom or greater autonomy, not opening ways for people to be fully incorporated into a host society, but drawing stark divisions based on ideas of race or innate biological and ancestral difference, and creating these different categories that some people were servants for life. And that category was a lifelong condition and was also one that was inherited, right, that was passed from mother to child. And what we see among the Choctaws is by the late 1700s that idea of slavery being lifelong and inherited and also associated with African ancestry really takes root among the Choctaws as it does among other Southern Indian peoples.
How prevalent was this slaveholding by Indians of people of African descent? And what did the missionaries think of the Indians' ownership of slaves?
Slaveholding among the Choctaws and Chickasaws and other Southern nations, in terms of percentages, looks fairly like slaveholding among white Southerners, right? That the majority of enslaved people are owned by a small minority of Native slaveholders, then that the majority of that wealth is also concentrated in the hands of a small elite class of plantation owners, but that certainly there were many more Native peoples who owned only a few enslaved people, one or two who worked on small farms with them. The missionaries, again, had a complicated relationship with Native slaveholders. On the one hand, missionaries were very committed to their project of assimilating Native peoples. And to that extent, while missionaries professed their anti-slavery sentiment, they were nonetheless willing to tolerate Native peoples' ownership of African Americans, right? And believed that that was the price they might have to pay for converting Native peoples, for enticing Native peoples to participate in this acculturation project of theirs. At the same time, missionaries could often be very critical of Native slaveholders. But what's interesting, I found, is that their criticism is voiced in terms that echoed prevailing racist sentiment towards Indians. That is, that missionaries would criticize Indian slaveholders for being especially bloodthirsty, especially cruel, lacking Christian benevolence like white slaveholders have. And so there was this sort of rhetoric that native slaveholders were bloodthirsty and savage. And at the same time, there was another seemingly contradictory rhetoric that said native slaveholders were absolutely lax and lenient and were nothing like white slaveholders because, of course, they lacked that Euro-American drive for wealth and property accumulation. And so that they were actually bad slaveholders, missionaries said, because they didn't know how to fully exploit black labor.
Well, there is a notion out there, and it's held by many, that Indians, by virtue of their Indianness, were somehow more lenient and more benevolent masters. What should be said about that?
Well, I think there are a lot of things we can say about that. In part, what interested me about this project that I did was thinking about how those ideas of Indians as benevolent masters in many ways reflect that history of colonialism, right? Of missionaries and other white Americans looking at Indians and saying, oh, they're so different from us. They don't understand capitalism. They don't want private wealth. And so they're flawed at keeping black people properly subjugated and properly exploited. And so I think there's an interesting history of racism underlying that narrative of Indian leniency. And at the same time, I think that there is a history of African-American, Native American alliance and joint efforts to resist U.S. imperialism and domination, and to resist white supremacy. And so I think some parts of that narrative of Native willingness to recognize black people's humanity comes from that very real history of joint opposition to that colonial project.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Barbara Krauthammer is my guest. She teaches history at UMass Amherst. And she contributed a chapter about missionaries, slaves, and Native Americans to the volume Formations of United States Colonialism, edited by Alyosha Goldstein and published by Duke University Press. And that chapter encapsulates some of what Barbara wrote in her book, Black Slaves, Indian Masters. We are talking specifically about the dynamics of power and control that arose as Indians, slaves, and missionaries encountered each other in the Deep South in the early 19th century. So let's delve deeper into this, the perceptions held by Choctaws toward the missionaries who moved into their communities. So on the one hand, you have these missionaries condemn the slaveholding of blacks, of people of African descent, by Indians. And on the other hand, as you said earlier, that some, at least some Choctaws, welcomed the missions to the degree that they saw the missions as a way of maybe helping their cause, helping their communities. What was the basis for this sense that, you know, maybe the missionaries and their political views might help me, or maybe something I learn at the missionary schools or churches could help me and help my community combat some of the pernicious agendas directed at Indians?
Choctaw leaders were terrifically savvy politicians, political strategists, and diplomats, right? Were terrifically savvy at negotiating and navigating that shifting terrain of diplomatic relations with the U.S. government. And I think that Choctaw leaders were acutely aware that they were in a precarious position in terms of their right to their territory and their right to self-government. And one of the strategies that many, certainly not all, but that many leaders embraced or flirted with sometimes was the strategy of welcoming missionaries with the goal not so much of Christian conversion. I don't think that was driving their interest in welcoming the missionaries. But I think many leaders understood that if their children gained English language education, gained greater familiarity with the American market economy, with American economic practices, gained contacts, right? Personal contacts with American political figures, leading merchants and bankers, for example, that they would be in a better position to do two things. First, to say to U.S. leaders, look, we're doing exactly what you wanted us to do, right? We've taken up private property. We've taken up commercial agriculture, right? We are as civilized as you asked us to be, on the one hand. And then on the other hand, they were also hopefully positioning themselves to better defend themselves, right? To say, right, we will speak in English and argue for our right to national sovereignty, right? Argue for our rights to safeguard our borders and our territories. And so I think that interest in courting the missionaries was really about gaining access to the tools that the federal government was trying to use against Native peoples, and that it was this very savvy decision to say, well, we will take those tools and use them for our defense.
And to what degree was this balanced by the sense that we need to be suspicious of these missionaries? They may try and abolish slavery in our midst, that kind of thing.
Right. Well, there was always a sense among those Native leaders who opposed any interaction with the missionaries to those who fully embraced interacting with the missionaries. There was always a skepticism of the missionaries' stated agenda and unstated agenda. And so there was always this sense that these anti-slavery missionaries were going to come and disrupt the existing economic patterns and wealth that was being generated through the ownership of enslaved workers. And so there is, on the one hand, this real concern that missionaries are going to disrupt the patterns of social and economic life in Choctaw territory. And there's also an understanding that this disruption itself is part of a colonial project, right? Is part of this insistence on the part of missionaries and federal agents to say, we know better than you about how your society should operate.
Your article in Formations of United States Colonialism begins with the dispatching of missionaries by the Boston-based American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions in the summer of 1818 to the Choctaw Indians territory in Mississippi. And so they go to this area, they set up shop, and you note, in fact, well, they noted that a number of black slaves owned by Choctaw Indian slaveholders, attended the public worship services held at the mission. What was behind this, and what motivated blacks to go to these worship services?
So enslaved black people went to mission churches because many of them were practicing Christians, had Christian roots and ties to black churches and black communities in other parts of the Deep South, those places from which they had been sold to Choctaw territory. So I think for some people it was a way of continuing not just their religious faith, but a sense of connection to the communities that they had been separated from. I think many enslaved people fully recognized the tense relationships between Native peoples and missionaries. And I think they often saw opportunities within those tense relationships between Natives and missionaries to better their own condition. That is, they found opportunities at the mission stations to gain some autonomy, right? To go to church meant not working for a few hours, right? Finding a way of escaping from a labor regime, for example. Finding a way to have social interactions and contact with other enslaved people that they might not have encountered in their daily routines.
Did the missions give enslaved people opportunities to resist the control of their Native American masters?
I don't know that the missionaries gave those opportunities for resistance as much as the enslaved people created and seized those opportunities. That is, I don't think the missionaries were really intent on pursuing an anti-slavery or abolition campaign among the Native peoples where they were living and working. I do think that the enslaved people saw opportunities to ameliorate their condition, right? Whether that took the form of laboring at the mission stations rather than on their owners' farms and plantations. Some enslaved people, for example, successfully negotiated to have missionaries hire them as laborers rather than remain on their masters' farms or plantations. And I think that for some enslaved people, that was an opportunity to distance themselves from what could be a grueling labor regime on a plantation. Some enslaved people were able to capitalize on missionaries' discomfort with chattel slavery by convincing missionaries to purchase them, purchase that enslaved person, and allow him or her to work off the price of their purchase, right? That is a sort of gradual emancipation through a negotiated labor arrangement. But that was not so often initiated by the missionaries, and I think much more often initiated by enslaved men and women themselves.
Can you talk about the extent to which these Black people engaged in spiritual practices away from the missions and also from their masters?
So many enslaved people in the Choctaw communities look to the mission stations as one outlet for Christian practices. But it seems clear from the records that people are also gathering on their own, gathering just in communities of enslaved people, often at night, often in secret, to worship according to their own traditions, their own beliefs, with their own interests and goals in mind. And this, I think, resonates very much with what we know about enslaved people's religious practices throughout the South in the early 19th century, right? That there's a fair amount of evidence that allows us to consider the ways in which enslaved people look to Christianity as both a sword and shield, right? As a way of sort of relieving themselves of the sense of burden of their enslavement, and also as the source of inspiration for combating their exploitation, either directly resisting their masters or having a sense of spiritual deliverance in the future. And there's some really lovely records that talk about the preachers who emerge from the enslaved community in the Choctaw Nation, of people who meet just with other enslaved people, who preach to them, who teach them. There are some accounts of people singing, gathering to sing spirituals at night or to sort of steal away from the fields and replenish their souls and their sense of community with each other through religion.
How does this play into what the late feminist historian Stephanie Camp called arrival geography?
Stephanie Camp's work was so central to my thinking about this idea of the use of space and different people's competing uses of space in the Choctaw Nation. And certainly, I think the ways in which enslaved people seized and used space within the nation, whether it was the space at the mission stations or spaces in the woods or in the fields for their own purposes and infused those spaces with meanings that had value to enslaved people, is very much in line with Stephanie Camp's idea of rival geography, right? That is, that plantation owners have a view of space in terms of work and control and subordination, and enslaved people used those same spaces for their own purposes and with their own interests, and often at odds with their master's desires.
Barbara Krauthammer is my guest. She's an associate professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She's author of Black Slaves, Indian Masters, Slavery, Emancipation, and Citizenship in the Native American South, which is the first full-length study of chattel slavery and the lives of enslaved people in the Choctaw and Chickasaw Indian nations. And she's also co-author with Deborah Willis of the book Envisioning Emancipation, Black Americans and the End of Slavery. You can find links to Barbara and her work on our website, againstthegrain.org. Okay, so we have this complex dynamic. On the one hand, you have these black slaves, then you have the Choctaw Indians, many of whom own these black slaves. You have the missionaries coming in, you have the white settlers coming in, you have the federal government with its agenda. I'm interested in how Euro-American elites compare the racial traits and the perceived racial fitness of Indians on the one hand and black people on the other.
I think for the most part in the early 19th century, certainly among many Euro-Americans, there was a sense that Native peoples had much greater potential, or what they might have called much greater racial fitness, as it were, for assimilation into the American mainstream. And I think there was always a sense that people of African descent could never be assimilated into the American mainstream. Even among those people, missionaries included, who claimed to abhor slavery, certainly in the early 19th century, that abhorrence of slavery, I think, was based more on sort of ideas of humanitarianism rather than an actual interest in black people's individuality and individual humanity.
You also write that certain missionaries did look more favorably on black believers than perhaps on Indian non-believers.
Right. So that was another interesting and certainly very contradictory aspect to the research that I did, that I think missionaries were in many ways very sympathetic towards black believers, black Christians, and in many ways relied on them to aid the colonial project of converting Native peoples, right? That many enslaved African Americans in the Choctaw Nation could speak both English and the Choctaw language. And so the missionaries relied on them to work as interpreters and translators. And so I do think that the missionaries felt a sense of Christian affinity with enslaved believers. And yet, on the other hand, I don't think the missionaries ever saw the enslaved African Americans as fully human, as people who really merited true autonomy and human dignity.
How were the blacks who did become interpreters, intermediaries of a sort between the missionaries and the Native Americans, how were these blacks treated?
So they were treated fairly well by the missionaries because the missionaries were really dependent on them, right? So a really interesting reversal of what we think of as the more familiar racial hierarchy of white dominance and black subordination, that this was a moment where missionaries would write that they were really dependent on the services of their translator and interpreter, because those were the people who had not only the language skills, but also really a sense of cultural fluency and could serve as cultural brokers between the missionaries and Native peoples.
What about how enslaved blacks thought of their Indian masters, in this case, their Choctaw Indian masters?
I think the range of opinion that enslaved people had about their masters in many ways parallel the kind of things that we see coming from enslaved people in other parts of the South. That is to say, many enslaved people spoke, sometimes quite openly and sometimes in veiled terms, about their masters' cruelty, right? About the separation of children from their parents, for example, right? The sale of children. And so there's some really striking testimonies of women remembering the sound of crying babies being taken from their mothers and sold to traders who are passing through. And so I think there is a very clear understanding among enslaved people that their native masters in many respects hold the ultimate control over their lives, over their well-being. There is also a fair amount of evidence that indicates the sexual abuse of enslaved women, right? All of subsequent generations through the 19th century and through the Civil War of African Americans who claim Native ancestry will often give personal testimony either in official settings or to government agents, for example, or in less official settings, and will say things like, my mother was a slave and my father was her master. And they're certainly not talking about loving domestic scenes of marriage and household, right? They're much more likely gesturing towards histories of rape and sexual exploitation. So I think that is one important component that is sometimes neglected when we think about what's clearly a very troubling and painful history for many people. And certainly there were people who looked upon their masters with a degree of kindness and recognized their masters as being more humane rather than less humane in terms of the treatment they meted out towards enslaved people, right? So masters who did not separate families by sale or masters who did not beat their laborers. But that's a bit of a bittersweet pill, right? If you have to be grateful that you weren't whipped or grateful that you weren't sold away from your children, puts gratitude, I think, in a difficult light.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Barbara Krauthammer is my guest. She's an associate professor of history at UMass Amherst, and she's author of Black Slaves, Indian Masters. We are talking specifically about a chapter she wrote about missionaries, slaves, and Native Americans in the U.S. Deep South, a chapter that she contributed to the volume Formations of United States Colonialism. So, as you write, the missionaries actually, they didn't get enough funding, or they didn't get the funding that they desired, so that they, to some degree, relied on Native American communities for funding and resources. And as you said before, earlier this hour, I guess it was good that some Indians did welcome the missions and missionaries into their communities and thus were able to provide the missionaries with some of the resources they needed. Something then did turn, though. There was sort of a change in Indian perceptions of missionaries. And of course, it was always kind of ambivalent, and different people thought differently of the missionaries. But what happened, especially in relation to laws passed by the Choctaw that were very unfriendly toward the missionaries and their activities?
As relations between the Choctaw Nation, the nation's leadership, and the U.S. federal government became increasingly tense, I think more Choctaw leaders became increasingly wary of the missionaries' presence in their nation and increasingly viewed missionaries not as a source of strategic tools and strategic information, but viewed missionaries more as outsiders who, at the end of the day, were going to ally themselves with the federal government and with U.S. colonial missions and interests. And so Choctaw legislators become increasingly, take an increasingly harsh stance towards the missionaries and impose strict limits on the kinds of contact that missionaries can have with enslaved people. And so in part, it's a way of constraining the missionaries, right? By passing laws that say missionaries can no longer instruct enslaved people in reading and writing and can no longer permit enslaved people to learn to read and write at the mission stations. So there's those kinds of laws are being passed. And while they're definitely aimed at the missionaries, I would also argue that those laws are also aimed at enslaved people. And that those laws that are ostensibly directed towards curbing missionaries' contact with enslaved people, constraining missionaries' ability to move through the Choctaw Territory, for example, that those laws are very much about curbing enslaved people's access to autonomy at the mission stations, curbing enslaved people's opportunities to negotiate with missionaries for their purchase and ultimate manumission. And so that those laws really serve a dual purpose, and that ultimately what those laws represent is an attempt by the native government to bolster its autonomy, right? And to sort of reaffirm native people's right to self-government.
And if we step back, you know, there's these categories, these names we assign to people like colonizer and colonized. And in your writings, you try and trouble that distinction, which is often presented as a very clear, demarcated line. So what have you told us this hour that you think plays into your effort to try and call that distinction into question?
Well, I think all of this history, right, if we look seriously at Native American history in the U.S. South and in the U.S. as a whole, we certainly have to trouble some of the ideas about white supremacy, right, vis-a-vis African Americans. And initially, that was what drew me to this work, that here were people negotiating about slavery, but it wasn't just a contest between white and black, right? That there were Native peoples playing really important roles in what we think of as national debates in the United States about the future of slavery in the southern states. And so I think that by taking Native people seriously as historical actors, we necessarily change the terms and the terrain of our understanding of U.S. history. And I think that taking seriously the difficult and painful and often controversial dimensions of some of this history of African American enslavement in Native communities can best be done with a degree of sensitivity towards the ways in which Native peoples were really brutally targeted and subjugated by the dominant U.S. culture and government. And that at the same time, that never stripped them of their sense of agency and their sense of autonomy and their sense of self, right, of cultural viability, of political viability, and of determination. And that sometimes that played out, that sense of agency played out in terms of subjugating other peoples and in terms of negotiating between the institution of slavery and U.S. efforts to subordinate Native peoples. And so I think that there are complex dynamics that once we really look at Native peoples seriously as historical actors and as fully developed, complicated people like everybody else in the story, that the terms automatically change.
And I think one thing that makes your work so important is that the place of enslaved Africans and African Americans in the very complicated relationships between missionaries and Indians, and also in the larger story of U.S. efforts to subjugate Indians in the Deep South, that story has gone largely unexamined. Why do you think that is?
I think there's an interesting parallel between the removal of Native peoples from the Deep South and the removal of Native peoples from our historical narratives, right? That there has been this erasure of Native American history and Native American peoples. And in part, I suppose the cynic in me would say that's the function of colonialism and white supremacy, right? This erasure and sort of a simplified narrative. I have really had the benefit of having a number of colleagues at different schools in different departments who have also been interested in this history of Native American, African American intersections. And so I think that there is a small but growing cohort of scholars and some really wonderful students and junior scholars who are really committed to thinking seriously about Native American history and the relationship between Native American history and what we call U.S. history.
Well, could part of the explanation also lie in the fact that, you know, it's not really politically correct, perhaps, to bring up the fact that Indians owned blacks?
Right. It's a difficult and painful history for many reasons to discuss Native people's ownership and exploitation of African Americans. And it's certainly not the only history of African American, Native American interaction in the Deep South. But I think it's an important history. And I think that we do ourselves and our students a disservice by ignoring it. And I think only by coming to terms with the complicated nature of this history can we better understand some of the current events that continue to revolve around the legacies of slavery and questions of race and racism in the West today.
On againstthegrain.org, you'll find links to the faculty page of my guest, Barbara Krauthammer, who teaches at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, to her book, Black Slaves, Indian Masters, and to the book, Formations of United States Colonialism, in which you can find the chapter that we have been discussing today. Thanks so much, Barbara, for joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
I want to thank Carolyn Gorse at WMUA for her technical assistance with today's program. And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.